Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
Good morning. 2 out of 3 Retro Computing Roundtable hosts say that this is Show 79, Sunday, July 20th, 2014.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Find my way back to Oz.
Good morning, gentlemen. Earl, how are you today?
I'm good, Michael. I'm really doing well. How are you?
Pretty good here. Old house is off the market. We've accepted a buyer, and now it's full steam ahead. Last of my computer-related material went into the 8-bit bunker over the weekend as well. So,
very nice.
Yeah. So, beside the last bookcase I moved in, I've put in my wine racks for 10 dozen storage. So, the 8-bit bunker is fully provisioned, which is a good thing. Remember, kids, don't drink and program. Paul, how are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm in the process of trying to assemble things to go to Kansas Fest. I leave for that soon. I'm sure you'll hear all kinds of stuff about that when I and everyone is back.
Any problems in picking what you want to take with you, or leaving space to bring back new treasures from Kansas Fest?
Oh yeah, no, that is the challenge. And have actually discovered, I'm not sure if this is new or if I just wasn't looking before or if anybody cares, but I just noticed on the airline site that you can't check, at least with the airline that I was using, you can't check computer-related equipment in checked baggage, which means I'm going to be shipping a bunch of stuff.
You mean into a suitcase that goes in the hold, or to boxing it up and putting it in the cargo hold of the plane?
Yeah, exactly. Very strange. You can ship Christmas trees. Javelins, yeah. But firearms, but
No, computers are far, far more dangerous. They make people think.
And we don't need any of that.
No, definitely not.
Paul, I hope that we hear some stuff during Kansas Fest. In fact, on the K-Fest mailing list, you notice some of us were crossing our fingers, lobbying, hoping that someone can do some live video from there, because that would really be fun. I mean, I couldn't go this year, and I just am crying bitter tears that I can't attend. But a small but meaningful consolation would be if there's any kind of live media. I mean, even if it was live audio. I mean, just something, you know. Throw the rest of us a bone.
Well, I'm sure people are thinking about it. I know that there's some concern about the bandwidth of our host, the host university giving us access, but yeah, audio shouldn't take very much. I think the trick is just actually to get something set up. I find that all minutes are taken up. It's really quite amazing how little I end up using Twitter and email and everything like that, because there's just stuff happening all the time. But yes, we'll try.
Yeah, well, it was a bit like when I went to the Oz K-Fest back in 2012. I had all these good intentions of doing some real-time tweeting and posting, and totally forgot all about it as I became totally enthralled in my first retro convention. So I'm sure that the difficult part is finding people who can spare the bandwidth to share. But yes, please do.
And I'm sure there will be at least pictures and probably video and lots of reports afterwards too. So,
well, let's see. How about we, because of the retro challenge that Earl and I are doing, how do you do your programming on your retro computer? We all admire them. We play games on them, some more than we care to admit. But how do we program them? Are you a basic programmer, or are you more close to the metal and use the assembler? Or perhaps do you program on your retro metal, or in the case of most of us, a lovely chrome plastic, use an emulator, or are you a cross-platform developer? So, Paul.
Yes.
How do you do your programming?
Well, I think what I have done most recently actually has been kind of like a combination of emulator and real machine, and pretty much strictly in assembly. And that works pretty well. And when I say assembly, that's not what I mean. I mean typing in the hex, you know, the opcodes. So I guess that's a machine language straight. But I actually just I'm in the midst of a project. I went on about it last time. That's working on imaging disks and things. And so there was a particular program that I wanted to try to write, which I did by starting the emulator on my Mac and sort of, you know, working out. It's a pretty basic program. It's essentially just takes the disk drive head and reads a little bit of each track of the disk as it runs the head along the sort of the whole surface of the disk, in order to try to figure out a way to synchronize one track with another. So I have some sample from each track sort of physically next to each other so that I can try to line up another image that I got. But it's a relatively straightforward program, and I really kind of like it. So, you know, I opened the emulator, I typed in the opcodes, I saved it on a disk image, then put it on an actual disk and booted it on the real hardware to run it in it. It works, I think. I don't know. It does the sample. It makes the drive head sort of make this pleasing whirring motion across the surface.
So it's doing the sound effects and lulling you into a false sense of success.
Right, exactly.
Tricky thing, those computers. So, Earl, fellow retro challenge programmer, how are you approaching your programming for your challenge? You've got several machines, three machines, three programs that you want to write for each. Are you doing it on the metal or in an emulator?
Well, I'm actually doing as much directly on the hardware as I can. There are occasions where I'm trying to solve something a little bit tricky, and I find that it really lowers the impedance if I can just do it on an emulator while I've got Google up on another screen trying to, you know, balance the old and the new. But most of the programming, I'm actually sitting on the actual computer, and I like that. I think it feels like part of the experience, and it's actually why I picked the three computers that I picked for the retro challenge. Some of the other ones that I have, it would have been more challenging, I think, to program directly on the metal, because the programs that I write for the retro challenge, I then want to take somehow and get them up on the internet, at least in snippets, so that I can share with the world what I'm doing. And with the three computers I picked, there are easy paths to get the files from the real metal to something like blogger.com. So, you know, that's part of it, is sharing the fun.
Sharing the code and the images directly rather than taking a few little happy snaps and posting the photos.
Exactly. Now, in terms of what languages I have used for the retro computers, I could say, probably without any hubris involved, I could probably say just name it. I think I've programmed in just about everything under the sun except Algol. And I feel bad that I've never actually taken Algol for a spin. But weird esoteric languages like Snowball and much maligned languages like Lisp, I've spent actually a decent amount of time in, strangely. And Forth is an oddball language that I'm really enjoying. It makes you think in a completely backwards sort of way, but more of a top-down rather than a ground-up sort of scenario. Now, assembly, I have a lot of admiration for people who program in assembly. I just can't seem to get into it. I took the time to learn 6502 assembly because it hits three of my favorite platforms, the Commodore, of course, and also Atari and Apple. And I think I understand it. I can look at it, and I can kind of divine what's going on, but I just can't program in it. Paul, how do you do that? I just can't seem to get down to that level and enjoy myself. I know some people just love it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that that is what I spent a lot of my youth doing this, but it is kind of neat. There's not too much to keep in your head, and there are a lot of kind of like macros in your head, you know, that you can use. So you know, I find I'm doing the same things over and over again, and I'm actually kind of pleased to be able to do that, because I had actually for quite a long time thought I've got a lot of sort of wasted brain space here, given that I can still remember by heart all of the opcodes. So at least I'm not wasting that, you know, like those memory bits in my head. But I think I like it. It's it definitely runs fast. But I think if I were going to try to do something at all large, I mean, the things I'm talking about are all, you know, 50 bytes long or something, you know, they're small little things just to solve one quick problem. But anything large, I would definitely not use 6502.
Oh, well, I'm with Earl. I've dabbled with a machine or assembler on the Apple II when I was at university. I'd type in routines out of magazines. I could follow a listing and understand what it's doing and tweak where I needed to, but I could never really get going from scratch. So I was more of your basic programmer, both the language and also I was fairly basic about it. I taught myself by pulling the early games apart. That was the only way I could learn to program. So I've basically stayed with basic. And that's what I'm using for my retro challenge. So let's try something basically, Michael. I'm writing a interpreter, which will take a indented, unline numbered listing and then process that through, and out the other end will come AppleSoft code. And then there's a few other options which I'll have on that, which will run a cruncher, which will optimize the code down to the smallest available, and then optionally invoke one of the compilers. I'm using Task, the AppleSoft compiler, mm-hmm. which was a Microsoft product, and that will then create effectively a P code module requiring a runtime library. But again, that makes it considerably faster than the interpretive basic that it would have run as. But those are more just post interpreter things. So that's what I'm currently working on. So really, I'd say that's my favorite language. I've dabbled in Pascal. My first language I learned was Fortran at university on punch cards. I've done quite a lot of COBOL programming on my mainframe background. The one that I found the strangest would have to be Lisp, which at university we used to say that stood for liberal insertion of superfluous parentheses.
Sounds about right. Yeah, sounds about right.
And Forth, I've really only looked at Forth. I haven't even played with that one. So, Earl, that's something you think that I should dabble in at some time?
I think that it would be fun to just haul out an interpreter and go through a handful of exercises in Forth. I don't know how deep you want to get into it, but I think it's fun to see the way that it deals with things with the stack. And if you've ever used something like RPN on an HP calculator where you push your operands and then do your operation, and if you program for something like an HP 41C or one of the other programmables, you get used to this idea that you build more and more powerful things using the stack as your temporary scratch pad. And that's very much the way that Forth operates. So I think you might find it fun if you've ever played around with any of those other technologies.
Well, don't have that to fall back onto, but I think I will give it a go at some time. My day-to-day programming is done in Perl, and I used to do a bit of C programming, but that was well over 10 years ago. But I'd like to sort of see Perl on some of these 8-bit machines. That would make me feel real at home on them. But I've programmed in BASIC, and I think that's what I keep falling back to when I'm using any of my 8-bit machines.
My impression of Perl is that it would probably, I think it would be too big for most of it. I'm not sure exactly how compact it is as a
no,
you know,
well,
it compiler.
It definitely isn't, but I suppose we can always dream, can't we? I'll just stick to Perl on Linux and AIX boxes and to see how I go back on 8-bit land. But,
I definitely aspire, I think, to try to work a little bit with Forth. Every year for the last 2 years, I have looked up enough Forth to be able to make some kind of joke on May 4th. But, other than that, it does look like an interesting way to kind of bend your thinking. And also I have, I think I've mentioned it several times, this little Fignition thing, which is a little kind of like modern component Forth machine that I would like to be able to do something with. So.
One of the advantages of Forth, it was written for modest platforms, and it still, I mean, even in its modern incarnations, is a quite efficient programming environment. It would probably take a long time, more than we have on the podcast, to explain why it lends itself to that, but I think once you play with it a little bit, you start to get the impression of why you could port this so easily or implement it on a new platform. And that, coming from those modest beginnings, makes Forth a good candidate for a lot of our vintage computers, because you've got this little memory footprint and modest processors, and when you run Forth on it, it's pretty speedy. It's way speedier than BASIC in a lot of cases, but it's still interactive like BASIC. So a lot of advantages. And a couple of things that just make you shake your head and go, wow, that's really weird and backwards, but kind of fun. So I'd encourage people to take a look at it.
That sounds like a good topic for a podcast there, Earl.
It just might be. Good idea, Michael.
I really do kind of like being forced to think in a different way. You know, I think that's one of the things that I like about Forth. There was another language that's not, I don't think it probably qualifies as retro. I remember using it on the Next platform, I think. You know, so retro if you count 10 years as the dividing line. But that was kind of interesting because it was modeled on kind of like a neural network or something. So it wasn't procedural. You basically write a bunch of sort of condition based rules. You know, so if some condition is met, this rule will fire, but you're not guaranteed that they'll happen in any order. And that's quite strange when you're coming from a very linear programming mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say what it was called? It was called Clips. I'm not sure. I'm sure there are other things like this, but this was, I believe, developed at NASA.
So basically, BASIC is my favorite programming language. Earl, would you say Forth's yours? Your favorite language?
Oh, boy.
I know. It's like saying which child you love the most, but
in terms of vintage languages, and I almost hesitate to call it vintage because it's still in such active use today, but I think C might be my favorite.
C's been around for a while. But I must admit, there are a lot of programmers out there that haven't actually programmed in C directly, but they're using a lot of the derivatives that are out there now. And Paul, so are you a closet assembler programmer, or do you have some higher level language that you actually prefer to use?
Oh, I think when I'm using retro machines, it's mainly BASIC if it's anything sort of serious or you know, requires some thinking. But in real life, I tend to use Ruby. Actually, that's what that's the command line Unix language that I have been mainly working with.
Yeah, I've seen that Ruby was a requirement for some of the online coursework that I was intending to do, so I might have to have a look at exactly what I can do with that and see where I can go with that. Okay, so there's quite a bit out there on whatever, BASIC and ROM or other languages that you load onto your 8-bit machine, so let us know how you go about doing your retro programming. So, Paul, as you've got the mic, a little bit of news about Inside Space War you've got there.
Yeah, so I just found this, and I don't know too much about it, but let me read, first of all, the description of Space War. Space War was conceived in 1961 by Martin Graetz, Stephen Russell, and Wayne Whitman. I probably mispronounced all of those names, but it was first realized on a PDP-1 in 1962 by Stephen Russell, Peter Sampson, Dan Edwards, and Martin Graetz, together with Alan Kotok, okay, and many other people, Steve Piner and Robert Saunders, since I started the list. But it is a video game, essentially. And what I'm pointing to with the link that will be in the show notes is a kind of like a deep archaeological look at the code that runs Space War. So it's actually quite interesting just to see the actual sort of PDP-1 instructions and how it works and how it kind of like was put together. There is a link there as well to an emulated Space War that you can play, which I have not spent much time playing, but it looks like it would be quite interesting. And it's, again, because it's one of these sort of old small resource computers, you actually have a chance to understand it sort of like, you know, head to foot. So it looks quite interesting. I haven't read it all myself yet, but I am looking forward to doing so.
No, it actually looks like quite an interesting read, but it just goes to show that whenever a computer comes onto the scene, you can be sure a programmer is going to write a game for it. Yeah. It's almost a universal truth.
And these Masswork guys they have a lot of fun things on their website. While you're overlooking at the Space War thing, you should check out some of their other demos and applications that they have. For instance, the Virtual 6502 emulator, which we were talking about assembly language just a few minutes ago. If you want to try your hand at a little bit of 6502 assembler right in your web browser, you can do that on their website.
Yeah, I thought the URL was familiar, but yeah, that's what that would have been the last time I did go to Masswork. So, yeah.
And also their Google BBS terminal is fun too. Googling like you're in the 1980s.
Interesting. Yes. Okay. So the whole site is worth looking at.
Yes, it is indeed.
Oh, that'll be definitely something to have a look at later on. There's quite a lot of interesting stuff there,
including an After Dark demo.
In the vein of that, I was just looking at some of my normal blog links, and just recently on the Grumpy Gamer blog, he's got some design notes on Maniac Mansion. I just love how people trip over documentation and notes and things of systems and software from the past. But this wasn't quite tripped over. He went back to some boxes that he had in storage, and I suppose it was a surprise in so much as forgot what was in there, but pulled out design and mock-ups for Maniac Mansion, some early screen mock-ups, and I just love the flow diagram of the game itself. Think of a large sheet of paper, lots of boxes describing the rooms, and then give a toddler a crayon to scribble over it, and that becomes the path and links. But yeah, it's great to see the documentation for these early games being preserved so that other people can see it. Really, it's behind the scenes of possibly someone's favorite game. I remember playing Maniac Mansion on a friend's machine back when didn't have anything better to do at university. Who wants to study? Who wants to get their assignments in on time when there's games that can be played? So it's actually interesting to see the design and how it was built up, the concepts, a little bit of humor put into the notes there by the programmers. But it's definitely a great little time capsule finding documentation like this.
You know what it reminds me of is a movie that you've seen for a long time, years or decades, and then they come out with a DVD, and the DVD has some bonus material, and you learn things about the making of the movie and some of the trivia about the casting or the production difficulties or that sort of thing. It's so fascinating that you can, like you say, see behind the scenes of the production of some of these things that we love. And with these games, I think it's even of more historical value than with some of the movie bonus material, that kind of stuff. I just love seeing this kind of stuff. It's almost like discovering some storyboards for an old Disney movie or something like that.
Yeah, this reminds me a bit of, I wound up with, I don't know if I've noticed, if I've mentioned this previously, but Don Wirth, who wrote, he co-wrote Beneath Apple DOS for the Apple II series, and also a game called Beneath Apple Manor. This is not a game I ever was particularly familiar with, but I wound up with his design notes for that. You know, so that's one of the things that they're sort of like this. One of the projects that I had hoped to be finished with by the Kansas Fest which hasn't happened, but it will happen soon, is to scan these things and kind of make them available. But it's interesting to see, and I'm sure it would be much more interesting if I had a lot of personal time invested in playing the game, but I'm sure that, you know, there are lots of people out there who do and will really find it interesting to see, you know, to sort of see how it developed. So yeah, it's neat. It's really neat that this stuff can get out there.
Mm-hmm. No, it's you look at the design notes and the structure, and from a programmer's perspective, it's still pretty much how you start mapping things out even today. And then you just look at what they had to do to take those concepts and then fit it into a much smaller programming environment than what we actually work with today. So that, to me, that makes it even a greater appreciation that they can take something that, you know, you could just imagine the multimedia that you could do this with today, and then just take the essence of that game and get it down to something that'll fit on a 5.25-inch floppy disk from way back then, and still actually have a totally enthralling game. So that that's great work by them. But, Earl, speaking of Commodore, you've got a note here about Vegas Expo Convex.
I can't believe that, you know, trying to hold up the Commodore banner, that I let this fall off my radar until only just a couple weeks before. So shame on me, but I will try to correct my oversight here and let people know that the Commodore Vegas Expo, they call it Convex, it's been running for a long time now. They're going to hold their version 10 event. This is going to be July the 26th through the 27th, so actually just 1 week away from now. Wow! Man, not much time to book those tickets, but it will be at Jockey Room 2 on the third floor at the Plaza Hotel and Casino. And that's located at 1 Main Street, Las Vegas, Nevada. And I've, of course, talked to a number of folks who have been at the various convexes. They always have a good time. Things that are brand new, breaking news in the Commodore world, usually get demoed at Convex. This is like the premier event every year where people drag their wares and you'll see new games or new techniques or new pieces of hardware, that kind of thing. So 6 days may be too short notice, but if you can go, go. And I expect that after the show, as usual, we'll have the typical array of pictures and presentations and that kind of thing. The show's going to run from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. both Saturday and Sunday. And they have a dinner, too, I think, on Saturday night. So we'll have a link in the show notes for more information. And after the show happens, maybe I can catch up with somebody who was there and see if we can get a little bit of a debrief. So that's Convex.
Oh, it's better than saying in one of our August show, Convex was on, but no.
And we forgot. Sorry, guys.
We've talked about conventions and a bit about programming and software in general. So time, I think, for a little bit of hardware. What's come through recently on the Apple II Enthusiasts group on Facebook is basically Charles Mangan's been at it again. This time he's taken an Apple IIc, he's grafting in a 7-inch LCD and putting it on a pop-up hinges and support system, and integrating those hinges and the release system. So after taking out the 5.25-inch floppy drive to give him all that space in a 2C, it is a beautiful piece of, I'll say, hacking. Have Dremel, will cut. but of course, where I can't draw, I can't cut a straight line. Charles's work is superb. It's neat. It's professional. It almost looks like, you know, how a 2C would have been released by Apple with a integrated LCD display, as opposed to that squashed format LCD, which cost all. Well, did it cost as much or even more than a 2C? I know that those Apple 2C LCDs are still going for around the $800 to $1,200 mark, so possibly about the same price as a 2C. But no, some great work by Charles. Of course, we were talking about his mini monitor 2 to sit on top of his Apple II Pi case on the last show, but now he's gone back to the one-to-one world and is producing this. So, gents, have either of you been watching what Charles has been doing with his LCD display in 2C?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw it when he started posting these things. The 2C, of course, is the portable one, which doesn't normally have a monitor, and actually also usually has a very heavy power brick behind it.
It's portable, but, as in not a self-contained battery.
Right, exactly, but. It's an interesting concept, and of course that's monitors are always kind of the problem that we're starting to get into as first of all, you know, CRTs die and modern monitors tend not to take composite in a meaningful way. So this is a neat kind of thing he set up. I'm a little uncomfortable about cutting the top off an Apple IIc, although I know that they, you know, there are lots of them.
Yeah, I'd be quite prepared to take someone else's Apple IIc and do it to it. Right. I don't think I'd do it to mine.
Exactly.
Because that's the 2C that I use is the one that I bought back in the early 80s. And I don't think I'd be wanting to do anything other than open it up and add standard add-ons. But no, I'd be quite happy to source myself a Apple IIc to do this to, or to swipe it off someone's desk, take the Dremel to it, just looking at what he's got there, and even to integrating the release suite catch into the back of the 2C above the RCA out, that for the standard machine, it looks like, you know, the way it would have been done by a computer manufacturer.
There may be cases also, no pun intended, where the case isn't in all that great a shape. And if you're looking at it and you're thinking, well, I could just toss this, or I can saw it up and make something neat out of it, that might be the situation here. I'm not sure that the 2C is rare enough at this point where you're committing sacrilege to chop it up.
That's basically what I mean. I wouldn't do it to mine because mine has sentimental value, but there are enough 2Cs out there that they're not about to suddenly explode in unappreciated value or unrealized value. But it's great to see, as you said, machines like this being given a new lease of life, especially that it is getting very difficult to find a monitor or even a TV that has the composite input.
A question, though, without a disk drive, what do you boot?
Well, he said that what he intends to do is to add one of the SD card reader devices in place of it, so that you're effectively plugging into the disk 2 interface of the Apple 2C. And as far as it knows, it's just another standard disk 2, but it's actually a SD card with an image. So the that's how that is being got around. And then also using a more modern and compact power supply. So whereas the standard 2C has a large external brick, and it is quite heavy. I remember accidentally dropping it onto my foot many, many years ago, and its presence was felt on my toes. Fortunately, the case survived, and I only sported a bruised toenail for a couple of months.
Ouch!
Oh yeah, it's a heavy beast, that power supply. But this would give you a built-in power supply, SD card on the disk 2 controller, 7-inch composite display. Be interesting to see what it looks like in 80 column mode, but I suppose a 7-inch monitor should be able to handle that. But it's more on down to how it handles the composite signal to the number of pixels for the actual LCD display. But
how it performs its interpolation.
Love to see this as a finished project, and possibly as a instructions for a do-it-yourself. Actually, I'd be quite happy with just finding out the brand of the monitor that he's using. That's be a great portable composite monitor to have for any of our 8-bit computers, so that if you're going along to a show or just taking your computer somewhere, that you've got a small and easy to transport display rather than trying to lug a CRT around. Because invariably the CRTs are bigger than our computers from back then, more fragile, and once they've died, it's also very difficult to find someone to repair them, because it's even more difficult to find someone, a TV service center these days, that isn't just a board replacer or we'll replace that under warranty. The old television serviceman is a dying breed. They used to be able to fix our old CRT monitors, but I think these days we're pretty much left to our own devices.
This would be a great Kansas Fest machine, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if just you could actually put it in your laptop bag as a laptop,
And avoid putting it in the checked luggage.
Right. Exactly. I have carried a something with the same form factor, the TC Plus, before, and it fits pretty well in laptop bags. One of the things I was going to say about the monitor is that the Apple signal is actually a little bit, it's not quite up to proper NTSC specs.
Yeah.
Right. So any monitor that actually works with an Apple has a really good shot of working with one of the other, one of the other 8-bit machines, because that's sort of a high a high standard to meet, to be able to work with the kind of not quite on target signal that it provides. The other thing too, that as he was discussing this the screen folds down and it's held in place by magnets. And immediately, all of the alarm bells went off in my head. It's just like, magnets, what? No, magnets cannot be anywhere near this machine. But of course, if there's no actual disk drive, then maybe it doesn't matter. But my terror of magnets has lasted ever since the mid-80s.
I don't know. I've actually tried to stuff up a disk with magnets, and I haven't been successful yet. So, your mileage may vary. But
I do remember in college. Actually, I remember at one point a 3.5-inch floppy falling off my desk, and I couldn't find it for a while. And eventually, it turned out it was stuck to the back of a guitar amplifier speaker, which is one very large magnet. And the disc worked fine. So who knows? Maybe it's all just false, this stuff that you have to worry about.
No. True story. Back in the aerospace days, we were trying to figure out why this person's word processing disc kept failing. And we replaced the software, the word processing software. I think we were using Multimate. And that didn't solve the problem. So, clean the disk drive. Nope. Replace the disk drive. Nope. Obviously, new set of floppy disks. No go. Pretty soon, just replace the whole machine. Something is wrong with the floppy controller or the motherboard or whatever. Finally, just threw up our hands, gave up. Said, we just can't figure out what's wrong, why your disks keep getting corrupted, we give up. And the person said, oh, well, okay, you guys tried. They took the floppy disk, took a magnet, and stuck it to their filing cabinet. Moment of silence while we look at this and go, wait a minute, is that the way you've been storing the disk? Yeah, what's wrong with that? forehead slaps all around, problem solved, but yes, I can tell you.
right, exactly.
That's the only part that we hadn't swapped out was the user. So I can tell you, you can corrupt these things with a magnet. Personal experience, and that's not a made up. That happened.
It is urban legend quality.
Oh,
that is excellent. I thought that where it was going was the user was putting it on the monitor, but this is even better.
I just love the thought of a floppy disk being held on. If you think of it purely from the user's perspective, it was a great idea. It was accessible. It was easy to put away. You knew where it was. Two out of three is not bad.
Exactly.
Whoops about the data part. Okay. So, Earl, while you've got the microphone, we've got a little bit of feedback, have we?
We do. We love when people send us emails, and there's a couple I'd like to cover here. First off, we talked a show or two ago about how to store the vintage equipment, how to preserve it so it doesn't break. What I should say, one of the things that we mentioned was storage as a preventative measure. And Brent wrote in and talked about his experience in storing his computers and his media. First off, he has some of his computers stored indoors in the Rubbermaid container, that approach that we talked about, and he's had good luck with that. He's also got some of the computers, overflow storage, if you will, out in his garage in a loft sort of an environment. They're in a cardboard box, but then wrapped in plastic, so they are sealed, so the little bugs and critters can't get in. He has seen basically no difference between the indoor storage and the outdoor storage. Has taken computers off of the shelf of this uncontrolled environment, and he lives in an area where there's temperature extremes, and thinking, I'm going to bring this computer in, I'm going to plug it in, it's going to blow up. It's not going to work. And it's never happened. So either this is just fantastic luck, or in principle, there hasn't been any difference for him and his equipment in terms of how he stored it, which I thought was interesting. I do have a small handful of things that are stored in the garage. I worry about them. I think about, wow, it gets pretty hot out there in the summer. Don't know. But on the other hand, I've never had anything fail either. So I appreciate the feedback, Brent. Also, and this was irony, he'd had some disks stored inside, temperature controlled environment, cool, dry sort of thing, and had terrible luck with the discs. I think it was for his Amiga. Had tried to get the thing to boot up, and no go. So, in desperation, reached for the backup discs that he had in the garage that had been out there in these temperature extremes and that, and by and large, they worked just great. So, go figure. I don't know what that means exactly.
The discs were probably cooked better.
Yeah, does it mean that we don't have to care, or that he was particularly lucky? But anyway, I appreciated the story and his particular experience. So thanks for that, Brent, and that's food for thought. Also, a few episodes ago, 76, I think, Michael, you had brought up that it sounded
that was from an article that was in the Guardian online in the UK, saying that you had to pay to enter Bletchley Park and pay separately to then visit the National Museum of Computing.
So Bletchley Park, in this case, kind of being the outer perimeter that you have to breach in order to get to the drawbridge for Tianmach. But Paul says he didn't have to do that. And I think that's good news. I don't know how or if or something like that we could talk to somebody over there with Tianmach to confirm that, or maybe actually there's somebody listening to the show.
I went back and had a look at their website now, and I think as a result of that article in The Guardian, they've put extra information on their webpage, not only how to get to them, putting a different postcode into your car's navigator system to take you to the right end of Bletchley Park. But yes, they appear to have a separate gate, separate parking, that you pay to go into the National Museum of Computing and to see their exhibits. And of course, if you have gone into Bletchley Park to look at what it has to offer, which also is quite a great place to visit from looking at their website. But yes, if you then want to go from Bletchley Park into the National Museum of Computing, of course you then have to pay that separate admission. But it's not a case of having to pay the gatekeeper to get in and then having to pay to separately go in and look at the displays at the National Museum of Computing. So that's a great clarification. And it just goes to show that if you're in the neighbourhood, and for us over there, say on holidays, there's plenty to see at both. I think I could give Bletchley Park itself a good part of a day, and then probably a day or two for the actual National Museum of Computing. So that's definitely on my list of places to go if I'm ever in the UK. So. It was great for Paul to give us that update and to show us that not quite the case of believing everything that you read in the newspaper.
Well, and Paul agrees with you that you could spend a whole day at Bletchley Park and a whole day, if not more, at the National Museum of Computing. He said both are great, and in terms of the Tianmach, that his kids loved it and they keep bugging him to go back, which I think is great. He notes it'll keep you engaged for the entire time that you're there. There's loads of different computer systems to play with, manuals you can read, which I thought that was cool. Also, he was mentioning many of the staff are obviously retro computing enthusiasts, which makes a lot of sense. So if I'm ever on that side of the pond, that's a must-see for me. I've got to get over there. And also, I listen from time to time to the Bletchley Park podcast, which you can find on iTunes, and one of the things that was fascinating to me was their efforts in trying to, with historical accuracy, recreate the grounds for Bletchley Park. You know, with restoration efforts, you're always thinking, I need to make it modern in some ways so that it will meet code and safe for people to walk through, but I also want to make it as much as possible like it was in those wartime years, so that people can get that taste of history. So an interesting podcast if people want to listen to that. Again, you could find that on iTunes. But, yeah, I appreciate Paul writing in. Thank you very much on that.
The progress of humankind is written in the history of its tools. Nowhere is this more evident than in the field of the graphic arts. From the crude daubing implements that were used to create the earliest known paintings some 15,000 years ago, to the simple bronze chisels that carved the hieroglyphs on the walls of the tombs of the Egyptian kings, to the precision brushwork of the medieval illuminated manuscripts, to the advent of Gutenberg's movable type printing press, all the way to today's high-speed digital color printing presses. Each time a graphic artist gets a hold of a new and important tool, the result is equally new and important. The Commodore Amiga 2000 personal computer is radically expanding the art of the possible in the world of art and design. We're going to show you ways you can use this affordable new tool to expand the art of the possible in your studio or business. As a way to illustrate in 4,096 colors, design logos and packages, to desktop publish in black and white and in color, and as a way to make winning presentations in virtually any medium. Now, look at what the Amiga 2000 can do for you.
The Retro Computer Society of Rhode Island have just recently acquired a Cray. Now, wouldn't everyone love to just get their own Cray supercomputer? And this is their J90 parallel vector processing system, which was used at Brown University Department of Physics. So it's only just arrived. They're getting it set up. Links to both the Rhode Island retro computer site, and also there's a separate blog there, Cray Jedi. It starts off with some comparative, I suppose, benchmarking of the Cray itself versus modern computers. Just some interesting bits on the physical aspects of the computer. So it's another good thing to see that the Cray has that aura and that name of the early supercomputers, and it's great to see that this has been put somewhere where it'll be loved and cared for, and I would love to get up close to a Cray. I've only ever seen photos of them or seen them in documentaries or movies, but it'd be nice to actually see one in the metal, I suppose. But I found the benchmarking interesting, that it was still giving modern day computers a run for their money because of the way that it handles the parallel processing, and it definitely still has quite a lot of grunt in it. It's just that there are bigger and gruntier supercomputers to do all that work these days. But I'll put notes for that one in there. I expect that we'll see more about this in the coming months and years as they integrate it into their collection.
And I think, as interesting for me as reading about this Cray that they acquired, is finding out about the Retro Computing Society of Rhode Island. It makes me wonder, I mean, we know about the Atlanta Historical Computing Society because of David's involvement, and I know about the Seattle Retro Computing Society just being so physically close, and we know about March, of course, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computer Hobbyists. I don't know, though, if there's a number of other groups that are just floating around out there that are doing things that we don't know about, and it would be cool to hear about these little pockets of retro computing in various areas. So if you're part of one of those groups, could you send us some email and let us know? We'd be happy to talk about your group on the air, and also just enthused to find out about it, because what fun.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I don't know about many of the other groups out there. I know there are some meetings that we've talked about happening in Europe and things like that. But definitely it would be interesting to know, you know, what else people are doing. And on the Cray, I would kind of like to at some point explore sort of how programming is done on that, because speaking of sort of bending your mind in a new way, it seems like that has got to be quite a tricky procedure to write something that can run in such a massively parallel way.
Well, that's it. Not only do you have to bend your mind to work in a different direction, you have to send it down several parallel paths at the same time. So I can barely spare enough of me to travel in a single direction, let alone figure out how to do something with programming for a parallel processing environment.
So, guys, help me out. I'm having a moment where I'm really feeling my age here. Did we talk about Cray recently on the show, or was there some other reason why? Recently, I was on a Cray historical research kind of tangent of my own. And I was reading on Wikipedia about Seymour Cray and about his history and going and digging out different bits and pieces of information about Cray's history. And I was trying to remember what got me started on that tangent. Was it something that we talked about, or was there a YouTube video?
I think there was a video at some stage, and a tangent might be a very loose description. We were talking about the Mac Pro, the new Cylinder Mac Pro at some stage, and I made the comment that it'd be great to have an expansion bay as a large disk that the Mac Pro sat on top, reminiscent of the Cray with its bench seat-like structure underneath it. So the Cray itself in various tangents does keep popping up, but it's good to see one that's going to get a little bit of exercise every now and again.
I'll tell you, the history of the whole thing is just incredibly fascinating. So if you haven't read about it, you should go read about it, and a good place to start is Wikipedia.
I think it was last time Carrington had mentioned a video that said, you know, the only existing video of Seymour Cray giving a talk, which we concluded isn't actually a true description of that video, but it was still interesting to watch. Mm. And I suspect that.
That's why. Thank you.
Curse you, Carrington.
Forehead slap. Okay, that's why actually it was a really good tangent. And that video, by the way, is really good if you can get through the first few minutes with the bad audio. But yeah, that's why I went off on that little crusade to learn about Cray. And it was a great crusade indeed. It's not a computer I'll be adding to my retro computing collection, but it was fun to go read about.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the host's fun spot, the gift suggestion. So you might have guessed from previous podcasts that I do have a small affection for the original Star Trek. So you're sitting there, you're watching TV, you want to change the channel, you grab the remote. Here is what I consider the remote. It's a Star Trek phaser remote control replica. So
awesome.
It's got a magnetic base to put somewhere, which probably would be a bit of a issue, seeing I don't have much metalwork exposed on my lounges. But I think I'd still find somewhere to holster the phaser. Of course, no self-respecting Klingon TV would take commands from a Federation remote control. But then I suppose you're not going to set it to stun, are you? But I just loved it when I came across this one. A little bit on the pricey side, $149.99. Currently out of stock, should be back in stock in November. So guys, bookmark this one. It'll be available just in time for Christmas. Just don't fight over it. Just one of you pick it for buying it for my Christmas present, and it'd be greatly appreciated.
it's probably about
dearer.
As well made.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say it's probably about as well made as the real ones. I mean, maybe even better.
I suspect that it's probably better quality than the ones that were actually made for the show.
I think it probably is, but here's the thing. You look at the price and you go, whoa, it's a little bit on the pricey side. But then when you read what went into actually creating this, you gain some appreciation for this isn't just some plastic that they threw together that kind of looks like a phaser. They really did their homework on creating this. So let me see, where did they talk about that? They talked about that here.
Oh, it's just down in the main description section. It's a very comprehensive description.
So they said it's recreated from 3D laser scans of the last known screen-used hero prop. So they actually stuck this thing in a scanner and spun it around and made sure that they had an accurate reproduction as opposed to just something cheap that they threw together.
Yeah, I love the throwaway line in the description. Just be sure you're not wearing a red shirt while aiming this at your TV set. We're pretty sure that voids the warranty.
It also voids you, so the warranty might not be as important then.
No, but I don't know if I'll be rushing off to buy this one, but I just couldn't resist putting it up there. I think my last gift suggestion was a set of Star Trek Original Series pajamas. What better to be lounging around watching TV in your Star Trek pajamas and needing to change the channel of the TV? Okay, well, speaking of other amazing bits and pieces out there, what did you find out in eBay land, Paul?
Well, there were a couple of things that I wanted to mention. So the serious one was I came across, so just sort of looking through the listings, came across a Casio FX730P. And I'm not sure if I've recommended these before, but it's one of these, it's one of the basic programmable calculators. And I have a sort of personal connection to it just because I remember going on a family vacation and, you know, feeling like as a kid, you know, not wanting to be torn away from my, you know, my computer and my programming, I was allowed to borrow one of these from a parent's friend. And so I spent the vacation as we were going through scenic West Coast, U.S., just programming on the little calculator. And then I had to give it back. And so I hadn't seen it again for a long time. I've got it. So as I got into the retro computing kick, I reconnected with my desire to get one of these things. And I like it just for the personal reason. But also I think it's actually one of the prettier ones. It's a really kind of a nice looking machine. So the Casio FX730P is a sort of calculator form factor thing that can run programs, has a couple different memory banks that you can run BASIC in. And the one I picked is actually starting, it's super cheap. So that's kind of why I pointed it out. I'm not sure if the description says, don't familiar with these, it does not turn on. So it's kind of a gamble, but at the moment it's $3. So it's not a very big gamble. And usually these things, when, you know, if you sort of look at the main listings, they're all in the you know, 60s and 80s and 120s. So might be worth a gamble to see. It might be just the battery needs to be replaced. There are a couple of batteries in the back. One hopes that it's not just that what happened is the old battery is still in there and has leaked all over everything. But anyway, that's my serious one. My less serious one is that somebody has put up a DEC PDP-8 for $18,000. Which we can all look at and think, boy, that was in the barn for you know 15 years or something. But so it's kind of beat up, but it is still, you know, it's a PDP-8.
A little bit on the dusty side, but I love the shot of the back there with all the wiring. It's definitely worth a look just to have a look at the pictures. So
it's a little bit sad, though. I mean, if you look at the front panel, it's in really bad shape. They want $18,000 for it. I don't suspect they're going to get it, but
you can make an offer.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if they'll take anything that has
that includes I will come and pick it up.
Yeah.
Now, it's true what they say, that there is more than one model of a PDP-8, and this one, the straight 8, is the most collectible of that particular series. If I remember my PDP-8 history correctly, they made about 50,000 of those computers, but of those 50,000, as they point out in this eBay article, only 1,450 of them were the straight eights. So it is, whenever I hear people talk about the PDP-8s and collecting one, or you know, kind of a badge of honor of having one, is this straight eight model. So if someone was adept at fixing things up, they might want to get this to try and refurbish it and clean it up and get it back. I don't know if they say in here if it's in working order or not, but the other thing is, like Michael says, you could make an offer, and it would be interesting to see, it's never been powered up since I acquired it 30 years ago. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. But also possibly wise. I mean, it might not be such a great idea to just turn it on to see if any lights come on.
You would definitely not want to do that with something like this. You'd want to go through extremely painstaking evaluation of all the circuitry and that sort of thing. But yeah, so I'm going to add this one to my watch list. It'd be interesting to see if it goes, and if so, for how much.
It's eBay actually recently has made it somewhat difficult to. There's a secret trick here, you can't normally see how much something goes for if it gets sold for a best offer. So if someone makes an offer and it gets accepted, but apparently, if you go to the print view, there's a sort of like some sort of legacy old version of the web page, and if you go to the print view on a completed auction that went for a best offer, you can see what the best offer was. So that will work until someone at eBay hears me say this and takes it out.
Yeah, so listeners, don't tell anybody.
But you retain your position as our RCR eBay expert, Paul.
Yeah.
Because you definitely know this stuff. I continue to be in awe of your adeptitude. That's not a word.
Thank you very much.
It
is now.
Yes. Although this is only a single PDP-8, it's a very impressive listing. Okay, Earl, what did you find out there in eBay land?
Nothing nearly as rare as Paul's, but I think, honestly, what seems like a pretty good deal. We've been talking about the color computer more of late on RCR, and here is a color computer 2. With its multi-pack expansion pack, and also one of the thermal printers, and all starting at $49.99. And this is all equipment in the original boxes. If you look at the pictures, it all looks like it's in beautiful shape. The person says it powers on, but they haven't tested it. I guess they don't know that with a color computer 2, you can just hook it straight up to a television set to see whether or not you get a signal. But in any event, it always irks me when people don't test these things. But at this price for all of this stuff, I kind of feel like it would be worth the risk. And this multi-pack is an interesting device. It goes in the expansion port of the color computer and then gives you multiple expansion ports that you can choose in between. So if you've got multiple devices that would normally plug into that interface, this will let you then select between those devices, maybe having to reset in between the selection. But that's a bunch of stuff for $49.99. And the shipping's not terrible to me. From Virginia, it's $35. I don't know. Do they sell to Australia, Michael?
They say that it ships to the Americas, Europe, Asia, and Australia. But shipping is calculate. So,
But it is in principle.
Yes, this just comes up with a message. This item will ship to Australia, but seller has not specified shipping options. So contact seller and request shipping method to your location. So,
But this does seem like a nice specimen of the color computer too.
Yeah.
In the original boxes.
The boxes are in nice shape too. The multi-pack looks like a really kind of a neat device. I don't think I've seen it for the color computer 2. I've seen similar things for the Commodore 64, though. I think you can get sort of, you know, sort of multi-slot things that will accept multiple cartridges that you can switch between. I periodically watch them on eBay and then don't do anything about it.
You can get them. I think that the computer it's more useful for is the VIC-20, because with the Commodore 64, you already had a bunch of RAM in there and that. But with the VIC-20, if you wanted to max it out on the RAM, you either needed a special cartridge or you needed one of those multi-slot sort of things that you could run. I remember having one of those back in the day when I had my VIC-20. So, yeah, I thought this was kind of neat. I don't know how rare they are, but I haven't actually seen one pop up on eBay before, those multi-packs. So,
yeah, my guess is it is actually relatively rare. It might be worth, you know, the starting price just for that.
All by itself, maybe.
Yeah. But the Aquarius too has something sort of like this. I remember, as you mentioned, the memory thing. That reminds me that the Aquarius has just one slot, but very often comes with a multi-pack expander because there are many cartridges that need, you know, 16K or whatever, and you actually have to put you can't both have the cartridge and the 16K in there unless you have the expander.
If you put the prerequisite memory in, then you can't put the cartridge in that needs it.
No. Right, exactly.
But it looks like quite a nice start. So if someone was looking to get into the color computer, that looks like a great way to start. And even for someone who has them already, it looks like a great collection of peripherals to go with the machine. So I'm sure that if it's not that it's all working, then I'd say pretty much there'd be some bits in there that do, and yeah, definitely if I was closer, I'd be tempted. But yeah, $49.99, a great starting price for that bundle. Well, for me, I decided to have a look at what was out there as educational on the retro computing side of things. So I got thinking of all those Texas Instrument educational devices that were out in the 80s. And so I've got here the Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. It's a looks like it's a good collection. Box is in great condition. The unit itself is running. And just shows that the way that the technology has changed as far as educational gadgets. So in the past, Mum and Dad would shell out probably a bit more than the $59.99 starting price for this one to buy it new. But these days, I suspect that most of the time it's popping over to Google Play or the Apple App Store and spending a couple of dollars to get an app onto either your phone or the iPad, which has been given over to the children to use. So it's a big change in the form factor for educational computing, I suppose. There were many different types of things like this back in the 80s. Just needed a little bit of something different, something for the kids.
I wonder, I've often wondered about the Speak and Spell, whether sort of what its relationship is with E.T., you know, so this became hugely famous because E.T. used it to, you know, communicate.
Mm.
But I wonder if it was famous already and they used it in the movie, or if the movie really is the thing that made it come to prominence. But of course, everybody knows this thing because it was in this huge movie. And I think actually it also made an appearance in Halt and Catch Fire. I think the mother was fixing it or something at a certain point.
These were really popular. I had the first computer store that I worked in wasn't just purely a computer store, but also a gadget shop. We had the Seiko watches and TI and HP calculators, the Atari 2600, all that sort of stuff. And among our various gadgets and wares, we had the Speak and Spell. And I thought these things were just so cool. Every now and then I'd sneak over when nobody was looking and punch a few buttons on it and listen to the speech synthesis and just think, what a great invention for kids, and it really did a good job and was pretty durable too. Things that are on the sales floor, especially things that get banged on by the kids, are your most likely to die the death of a rag doll. But this actually held up pretty well. It looks like the one in this auction is in really nice shape. No cracks, no smudges. This looks beautiful.
Yeah, the box is in good condition. Seems to have all the ancillary documentation. If someone out there is collecting retro kids' educational devices, I think this one deserves to be in a collection somewhere.
Definitely, yeah. It must have been somebody who was kind of in a collecting mindset to keep it in the first place, because this is, you never see it like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always just some beat up thing from the bottom of someone's, from a shelf in the attic or something. This is great.
Yeah, especially all the brochures, everything's there. It's a great little snapshot of the kids' educational hardware from the 80s. Well, gentlemen, that pretty well wraps up this show. So, Earl, anything you want to add before we close out the show today?
Just that I'm lighting the engines back up for a retro challenge. We had some old friends come up and stay with us for a week, and it was wonderful to see them. But during their visit, of course, I didn't have any retro computing time, which was definitely a worthwhile compromise. However, it does put me a bit behind the eight ball now, so I have to get going. And I'm excited to get back to writing these games.
Yes.
Cool.
Oh, same here. I'm a little bit behind. Everything's moved into the 8-bit bunker, so I suppose it's time for me to, after bringing order unto chaos, it's time to get back into programming mode and see how much I can actually get written up and posted and see how I go. Of course, Carrington is a one-man invasion of the Kansas City area, and he'll be meeting up with you, Paul, for Kansas Fest, but...
And I think Dr. Steve will also be there.
Okay.
I think RCR will have a pretty good representation there. There'll be lots of discussion afterwards, no doubt.
Three from RCR, just like the first time we went in 2012. We had three of us. We did the show live from there.
Oh,
yeah, and it was
maybe they'll find some time to do a special Kansas Fest feature.
That would be fun. Nudge, nudge.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah, I think there actually is a large podcasting contingent there. I think maybe 2/3 of Antic will be there, Anyway, many many people, many sort of podcast types. So I imagine that there will be a bit of recording if there's any time free.
I think that's the operative. If there's any time free,
right?
Okay, well. That's it for this show. You'll find show notes and for all the RCR shows over at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the RCR shows over at the Vintage Computer VCF forum, or VC forum. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And of course, we always love to hear from you, so send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're also a member of the Throwback Network. And please, if you're over on iTunes, drop in, give us a review. It'll help other enthusiasts find us. So, until next time,
Retro Compute.